Good afternoon. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order for our supplemental session. We have three bills that we have scheduled for today. And just let everyone that's out there know the order that we're going to proceed. We're going to start with SB 1086, followed by 1088, and then we'll conclude with 1072. And first of all, I want to thank everyone for being here and colleagues. And Fred, thank you very much for getting your appointment done and being willing to step in and be part of our judiciary.
Thank you.
And we have able staff, so if you need any assistance, Mr. Taylor.
I'm sure I'll make use of them.
All righty. And also to our staff that's helping us record and everything, please make sure that we're on the record when we need to be on the record. If there's something that we need to do, let us know. If you can't hear anyone, please don't hesitate. We'll make sure everyone is on board. With that, Council, why don't you give us a overview on I'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1086.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1086 comes to you for the request of Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. You may remember House Bill 3407 from last session, where we made some changes concerning the public records relating to public safety officers, district attorneys, and assistant attorney generals. In doing that, we inadvertently created the possibility that records that were otherwise not open to public disclosure, held by the Department of Police, DPSST, were now open to public disclosure, and that was inadvertent. And the Senate Bill 1086, as amended, you have the set of amendments before you, will close that loophole, and so that the information, personal information that a police officer has and gives to that agency will not be subject to public disclosure. Everyone that was participated in this process, last session, the Department of Justice, the Newspaper Publishers Association, the Chiefs of Police, and others, and I believe the district attorneys are all on board in this as far as the amendment goes. But we have Dave Hendricks from Legislative Counsel's Office here to explain exactly how the amendment gets there.
All right. Thank you very much for that commentary. What we're going to do is we're going to go in a recess on Senate Bill 1086, and we're going to open up, I guess what we probably need to do is a work session first on our Senate Committee rules for judiciary.
That's right.
So as quick as we want to get through this, we better have some rules to act under. So we'll open up that work session. Council, if you can give us the overview of the rules.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these are rules that every committee has before it. Basically, they it requires a majority of the members of the committee to conduct business. They're before you. I think you've seen them before. What else could I add to it?
It sounds good to me. Let me ask, does anyone on the committee have any questions specifically about the rules? My understanding, these are the generic rules that have been issued for all of the special session committees. And if there's any need for discussion, now's the time. If not, I'm going to ask that they be adopted. And what I would ask is for a motion for that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move we adopt the Senate Committee on Judiciary Committee rules for the 2008 special session.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Not seeing or hearing any, they will be adopted. And now we'll reopen our public hearing on Senate Bill 1086. And I understand that we were just at this point needing to maybe call in
Mr. Hendricks, Dave Hendricks from Legislative Counsel's Office.
Mr. Hendricks, why don't you come up and give us an overview as to what we have before us and why we have it?
We have a hand engrossed version of the bill plus the amendments, so you should have both in your packet before you.
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from Legislative Counsel's Office. I really don't have much to add to what committee counsel has already told you. The sole effect of the bill, of the amendments, will be to add to the category of records that can be exempted under public records law the home address and home telephone number of a public safety officer contained in records of the BPSST, Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, and it would only happen if requested by the public safety officer. It's been brought to my attention that apparently the name of the board is now the department, and we still have a board in here. I think that's something we can address back in the office with a correction when we get it back in for purposes of engrossment. I'll check and make sure on that. I don't think it makes much difference. The intent, of course, is clearly that this is for the Department of Public Safety's standards and training.
All right. Mr. Hendricks, is there any reason that the committee would need to do anything besides what you have done on the record to give you that authority to make those changes? Should we?
I think not. If you would like, I think this is one of those rare occasions where we'd be able to make an adjustment and provide a revised amendment to council for purposes of dropping the bill. Because it's a very simple and quick one to make, and I think maybe that would be good. I can quickly do it after it. I think you can adopt it with it is, with the understanding that we will make the change to the department.
All right. Does everyone follow where we're going with this? It sounds like we will be needing to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, and then that will take care of everything that we would need at this point.
And we, with the instruction to us to change the board to Department of for the purposes of another set to be provided to council to be dropped.
Okay, we'll put that in the motion then. And thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Hendricks? Thank you, Dave. We have three individuals that have signed up. I understand that maybe there had been some discussion pre-hearing today let's say those individuals may not need to speak now, but I'm going to allow each of those who have signed up, if they want to, if you put a thumb up or hands up, that way I know. Thumbs down, and let's see, Marilyn. And that's going to all three of them down. So that means no one wants to speak on this. And so this time, the chair would entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 1086 with the granting the authority for legislative council to amend board to department.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
We have a motion before us, been moved by Senator Wissett. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just would like to see a nod from the Oregon Newspapers Publishers Association. Thank you. So noted.
The nod is noting that they don't object.
Right.
Okay. I expected them to testify.
Well, he made himself available, but he said that he wouldn't unless we just wanted him to come up so he could say everything that he just nodded to.
Or that we had another amendment that might have come out, but that's not happening.
All right. So is there any objection? So ordered.
Yeah.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1086, and we're going to go ahead and move into Senate Bill.
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah.
Oh.
We just.
Oh, sorry, that's right.
Amendment.
So, motion on the bill. We're back in work session on 1086. We're trying to get through this really quick. And we'll take a motion to move the bill now it's been amended.
I so moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick moves the bill to the floor with a.
Due pass recommendation.
Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And do I have a carrier for our first bill coming out of the... I agree. Senator Garrard, thank you very much for volunteering as our newest member to carry the first bill onto the floor. And as you probably know from the House side, I'd be prepared for those peppering questions that I expect will be coming with this bill.
I might be ambushed.
We'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 1086, and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1088.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1088 comes to you at the request of the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee and came in for the Department of Motor Vehicles. Clarifies that a juvenile court has the same authority to order suspension of driving privileges of a juvenile offender that the circuit court has for an adult. You have the Dash 1 amendments and front of you, and I believe they've been worked out with the Department of Motor Vehicles and the courts, Timothy Travis in particular. And I believe we have a sign-up sheet with
we do.
Jack Evans, as he has signed up to testify, and I don't know whether I don't see Timothy Travis in his beard here, so maybe he's left. But
right.
Oh, here he is.
Mr. Evans, come on up. And Tim, while he's coming up, no need to testify? All right, thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, here to talk to you about Senate Bill 1088, which deals with the posting of offenses to juvenile driving records. This bill comes to us, came to our attention that there was an error in the reorganization of ORS 8, of Chapter 809 during the 2003 session. And that effort was to clean up that statute, reorganize it, cut it up into smaller, more manageable statutes, group things together, but not to make any substantive changes. Inadvertently, a substantive change was made to that section 809.412, which we just discovered and wish to correct. And what that does is this measure will restore authority to revoke and suspend driving privileges of youth offenders who commit traffic offenses under the vehicle code, and will restore DMV's authority to post these to the youth offender's driving record. When this chapter was rewritten, it had originally had covered all of the offenses that dealt with mandatory suspensions and revocations. When it was rewritten, it was narrowed down to two statutes, 809-409 and 809-411 only. Those two deal with, 409 deals with serious revocations such as manslaughter, offenses that involve fleeing from an accident where there's been an injury, and 809.411 is a similar statute that deals with suspensions, and such as reckless driving, fleeing the police, those types of things. What's left out are all the other offenses that could result in the suspension or revocation of driving privileges, such as DUI, and also the Provisional Driver Improvement Program and other types of offenses that DMV would post to the individual's driving record. As a result, the juvenile court would be unable to suspend or revoke for some of these convictions, and DMV would be unable to post them to the drive record. So if there are subsequent offenses where there's an accumulation that enhances the penalty, such as the habitual offender program or driver improvement or DUI, DMV would be unable to enhance those penalties. We're asking that this be put into place immediately if passed, so that we can continue to post these to the record, and so that the juvenile court could have the authority, a similar authority in these particular situations, to retrieve an individual's driver's license and to impose a suspension or a revocation at the time of a conviction. So we're looking for your support of this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I was just checking to make sure they have an e-clause on there, and you do have that in your Dash 1 amendment.
That's correct, Senator.
All right. Thank you. Anything else? Mr. Evans, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1088? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1088 and open the work session on 1088.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1088.
Senator Wissett moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 1088. Any discussions? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1088 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wissett moves Senate Bill 1088 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And the chair will carry this one. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 1088 and open a work session, a public hearing on Senate Bill 1072.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1072 comes to you from Senator Peter Courtney. It increases the penalty for participating in dogfighting from an A misdemeanor to a C felony, increases the penalty for possessing dogfighting paraphernalia from an A misdemeanor to a C felony, defines for the purposes of dogfighting paraphernalia a treadmill as a carpet mill made of narrow section of a carpet a modified electric treadmill for the purpose of conditioning dogs, or a slat mill for running surface constructed of wooden slats. Requires the possession of this material be for the purpose of training a dog as a fighting dog.
All right. And why don't we go ahead?
Senator Courtney's here.
Okay. And we're going to go ahead and start off with Senator Courtney. And, Senator, anyone that you'd like to bring with you, if anyone?
Yeah, I'd like to bring about
go for
400
it.
People to help me with the measure.
Is your cell phone off, Mr. President?
You know, that was an interesting story. I had to be down in Lane County Circuit Court yesterday, and they made an announcement. One of the clerks said that all cell phones must be off. The judge came in, made the same announcement. I had to step out, and when I came back in, the deputy had confiscated a phone of someone that must have gone off. Then one of the local defense attorneys walked a individual up to the podium and said that who he was, and that he had this gentleman that wanted to apologize to the court. Which he did. He got his phone back, and the deputy was saying that would have been $25. So apparently down in Lane County Circuit Court, there's a contempt of $25 if your phone is on. So we might be able to pay for a few more projects here.
Well, Mr. Chair, in my committee, you have to make a contribution to the Common School Fund. So
$25?
I mean,
the courts?
First offenders, maybe, but if after that, it's a little higher.
Right. President Courtney.
Thank you. I'm Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Islandview Drive, Northeast in Salem at 97303. I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem, all of Jervis and Woodburn. It's a pleasure and honor to be before the Augusta Senate Committee on Judiciary to discuss and support Senate Bill 1072, which I introduced for this session. And this involves dogfighting perpetrators and spectators. And I have a long history in dealing with animal cruelty issues. Well, I learned through the advocates that there were major loopholes involving dogfighting bills involving perpetrators as well as spectators. I agreed to introduce this bill for this particular session. There will be a number of individuals testifying with me who will outline the issues involving the bill as well as the issues involving dogfighting in Oregon. This bill is simple. It increases the current penalty for attending a dogfight from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony. In addition, it increases the penalty for possession of dogfighting paraphernalia from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony. It also adds treadmills to this list when intended. For use in the training of dogs for fighting. Because of the growing concern about dog fighting, Oregon law enforcement agencies have even sponsored several investigating illegal animal fighting courses in Madras and Salem just over the past few months. I am joined today by law enforcement officials who deal with crime on a daily basis. They're represented from the Portland Police Bureau, Department of Justice, Organized Crime Wing, Association of Chiefs of Police, and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association are here today in support of this bill. We're also joined by representatives of the Humane Society, the Animal Defense Fund, and Multnomah County Animal Services. This legislation addresses a real problem and closes loophole which currently exists. I thank you for your attention to these experts and for allowing me to testify today. I was actually surprised when I introduced the bill. I actually saw dogfighting as something that was focusing in the East Coast. I think you know why, because of the famous case now involving the football player for the Atlanta Falcons. When I introduced the bill, I did not know that actually dogfighting, although illegal, it does go on in Oregon, and we'll find that out, and which surprised me to the extent it does. So with that, I would like to now turn it over, Mr. Chair, unless you have questions or comments, Chris and me, to others who will get into the details of what is going on in Oregon today regarding dogfighting.
Any questions for the President?
Just one, Mr. President. I don't see an e-clause on here.
That's correct.
Do you want one? Otherwise, this doesn't stop this practice until January of 2009.
That's a very good question, and my staff is probably going to enjoy this immensely because they were pushing me hard on this, and I said, well, I want the bill to move, et cetera, et cetera. You're right. Typically, say, Mr. Chair, Chair Bozanski, Senator Walker, there should be, if you feel that that you're going to hear enough today that, number one, you want to support the bill, and number two, you think you want to stop it, then it makes sense to put an emergency clause on it. I won't deny that.
Okay. Thank you.
My name is Ron Nelson. I'm a special agent with the Oregon Department of Justice, Criminal Justice Division. I've been working as a special agent for 18 years, and I believe I'm also a past president of the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. And the reason I'm here to testify is because I did have some experience through a drug enforcement case. It's somewhat historical, but I think it would be a good point to start at, to show that historically we have had dogfighting in the state of Oregon. It does have a nexus to illegal controlled substances and several other crimes. So what I'm also going to testify about is the organization involved and why I believe that in many cases it can be seen as organized crime, a business enterprise for profit. And the best way I can do that, I think, is to explain the criminal investigation I conducted, which hits all of those types of areas. In the early 90s, there was a person in a different law enforcement jurisdiction from outside of Marion County, and he was trafficking in precursor chemicals for the manufacture of methamphetamine. He was also a person who was very familiar with dogfighting, had some involvement with people in dogfighting, and after they arrested him, thank you, he decided to cooperate with law enforcement. The first thing that he cooperated with was a conspiracy to commit murder case. He investigated that case with the law enforcement officers. That case came to a successful conclusion, at which time they came to me at the Oregon Department of Justice because this person also had information about marijuana grows and dogfighting. At the time, I wasn't familiar with dogfighting in Oregon as a police officer, knew it existed, but just didn't have occasion to investigate it. But I was familiar with drug enforcement cases, so we took the case, investigated the marijuana growing activity as well as the dogfighting activity. And through the course of that investigation, I conducted some research into dogfighting, found that it was an organized activity, that it was there was a lot of communication amongst dogfighters in Oregon, underground communications, and throughout the United States. These people would had underground publications that spoke about dogfights that had occurred, details about the fights, which dogs became champions, eventual stud fees, and so forth. So what we did was we obtained and executed search warrants on this person's two residences in Marion County. And what we found there was two marijuana grows and 25 pit bulls. Now, these pit bulls had battle scars from dog fights, and at the residences we saw many of the instruments for training, such as the treadmills, the breaking sticks and so forth, many of the things that are mentioned in the bill. And so for that reason, on behalf of the Oregon Department of Justice and the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association, I'm saying that we do have experience, long-term experience in Oregon with not only dogfighting, but some collateral crimes that also are involved with dogfighting.
Thank you, Special Agent. Any questions for Agent Nelson? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. First, I want to say I have no compassion for those who participate in dogfights, period. 5-year prison sentences is a pretty significant incarceration for someone. on the attendance, it says knowingly attended. For the legislative record, would you tell us what knowingly means there? I mean, is that could have known or should have known or did know?
Well, I can tell you from the perspective of a police officer, but not necessarily as a lawyer. When we would investigate something like this, looking for knowingly and intentionally engaging in criminal activity, we would gather evidence that would hopefully prove that they did know what they were doing and that they had the intention, in this case, of fighting dogs. Now, before we enter into any kind of an arrest under those situations, we gather a lot of information and evidence to develop probable cause. Oftentimes we will seek search warrants through affidavits to the court for with that probable cause in order to search for further evidence. We'll also, as I discussed here, work with people who are familiar with the internal workings of a criminal organization as, say, informants or sources. So there's a whole multitude of things that create knowledge and intent. Does that answer your question?
It actually answers that question and the next one I was going to ask you, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Garrard?
Oh, thank you. I have a couple questions. One is, I kind of like to look at some of the specifics. On the second page, line 5, line F, it talks about a leather or mesh collar with a strap more than 2 inches in width. That actually is part of existing language, and I just kind of was surprised that a leather collar 2 inches in width would be associated with dogfighting. I mean, it just seems like we can get in trouble with that. Why do they use thicker collars, and why does that have to be included?
Well, I'm going to have to defer to people that are actually investigating animal fighting, would have more expertise in those areas than I do.
Or do we have somebody up there could answer some of that? Okay, because the other one I have is with treadmills, and do they, like field trial dogs and that sort of thing, do they use treadmills? You know, like there's...
I don't know.
Okay.
Any other questions? Just for the record, on the knowingly, under the criminal liability, if we looked under 161.085, sub 8, it gives a definition that basically says that a person acts with the awareness that the conduct of the person is of a nature so described or a circumstance so described exists. So they basically would have to be able to be shown that they knew that this was a dogfight event that was occurring and they were in attendance at it. That's the way I would interpret it. So, and then the other part, I guess I'd say, and Senator Garrard brought this up because I really start looking at as to the definitions that we have here, such as the treadmill. And I guess the comfort I have now is that it has put in the caption, when you look under Section 2, under lines 13 and 14, that the paraphernalia to be used is to train a dog as a fighting dog or to be used in the furtherance of a dog fight. Because when I first just looked at the definitions and saw what makes up or what could be a treadmill, it could have so many different applications. So it seems like they've tightened it up that way. Sasha?
Chair Posonsky, Senator Girard. My name's Sasha Pollack. I work for Senator Courtney's office. I was going to speak to the treadmill incident. There are treadmills that are used. The veterinary rehabilitation programs sometimes use very specific types of treadmills for rehabilitating dogs, and we have heard that they are used in other instances. We were informed by legislative counsel this language is tight enough that it will not get folks who are not training dogs for dog fighting in this language.
Right. Okay. I also thought the same other ways as training a dog for other professional sports, even if they were as part of a sled team, I wouldn't be surprised if they may use that type of thing for the endurance. So, any other questions for anyone on this panel? Thank you. I do have one question, and this is really going to be for all those who are going to be coming afterwards, because I'm not sure who may have the answer to this. There's been a question as to raising the dogfighting for being a participant in a dogfight from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony. Was there any research done as to other states and if this is something that would be within that practice? Because I think that's one of those things we want to realize as to the impact we may be bringing into the state system as compared to this as a misdemeanor would stay at the local level.
Chair Prasansky, I believe Kelly Peterson will actually have a map of the different states and their penalties for dogfighting.
Fair enough. Thank you. And let's see, our next group of individuals. Kelly, why don't you go ahead and come up? And I have Detective Molly, it's at Dahl. And Kelly, was there anyone else that you wanted to make?
Who else is next on this bench?
Michael Swad. And I've got Scott Heiser.
Yeah, both of them.
Okay, well, why don't we just do three now?
Okay.
So, Scott, why don't you go ahead and come on up, and then we'll pick up the others in the next panel.
Certainly. Chair Prasansky, I'm Molly Dahl, and I'm a homicide detective from the Portland Police Bureau. You're probably wondering why a homicide detective is testifying on behalf of a dogfighting bill, but I will tell you, I am the champion of those without voices, and I think that this also includes animals as well as humans. Last year, I was investigating a homicide when I stumbled across a dogfighter, and luckily I had some previous training in recognizing animal fighting paraphernalia, other than the obvious injured dogs that were at my crime scene. I couldn't ignore the atrocities, and I couldn't walk away from the dogs. I stared at the face of an injured pit bull that had injuries to its face, head, eyes, and I saw the bottles of antibiotics, needles, hair growth stimulants that would suffice as medical attention instead of alerting a veterinarian. I saw the plywood walls used to make the fighting pits, treadmills used to strengthen and condition the fighting dogs. I saw the blood spatter and smears on the walls and the carpet. I've seen the puppies, the overbreeding, the bait animals, which are used in the training to give them a bloodlust. The heavy chains and the weighted collars, in reference to your question, certain collars are weighted, and in their size, it builds strength and endurance for neck, which is the important muscles in a fighting dog. And they use the chains that are affixed to these collars also to build neck strength in fighting. I saw the huge amounts of money that are involved in this and the multitude of kennels across the United States in my research that are involved. Dogs that I did stumble across were actually shipped from North Carolina, and these are from highly touted fighting bloodlines that go back almost a century. What I've discovered is that dogfighting is alive and well in Oregon. Until recently, the public has probably chosen to believe that dogfighting doesn't exist, but due to the shameful participation of certain professional athletes locally and nationally, the sport has come to light. Historically, dogfighting has been here a long time, but there's an alarming trend now, and it has mixed with our urban inner cities in virtually every state in the United States. It has traveled and it has been embraced by armed drug dealers and gangsters. And it is a criminal enterprise that closely associates itself to violence, namely murder. And that's what I came across. The city of Portland is currently involved in a murder trial that stemmed from a dogfighting match. The money stakes are higher now with this mix of criminal element. And with any criminal entity, concealment from law enforcement is vital to its success. I believe the passage of this bill will help thwart those who seek involvement in dogfighting. Without betting spectators, dogfighting would lose its lucrative allure. Clearly, we can't criminalize ignorance, but we can sanction upon those who participate in this barbaric and backward crime. We are the stewards of these animals, and to do anything less, in my eyes, is a crime. I've seen the violence that humans inflict upon each other, but I have to say that dog fighting is probably one of the lowest forms of humanity that I've seen. And I'll use a tired phrase among animal rights activists by Mahatma Gandhi: the greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way animals are treated. And I'm hoping that Oregon can be an example in this progress. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Detective. Any questions? Yes.
Good question, ma'am. My understanding is, as you know, a person who's convicted of a felony cannot possess a firearm. But I understand many people who have been convicted of felonies and still involved in crime oftentimes will have a pit bull. Is that correct?
Well, it can be true in some occasions. I think that they're used in fighting, but they're also used as status symbols. They're used as guards for their whatever kind of, you know, things that they're harboring inside their domestic residence.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I see the state of Washington is one of the ones where the dog fighting is a felony. In talking to your colleagues, if you do across the border, is there any noticeable difference in attendance at these events, or has it made a difference in Washington to have them be a felony?
I can't say that I have knowledge that there's an impact on the attendance. Dog fights are highly clandestine. Oftentimes, law enforcement has to utilize an informant, if you will, to gain access to these dog fights. They're so underground.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other questions? Scott, why don't you go ahead and go next?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Heiser. I'm the former Benton County DA, past president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I jumped ship and joined the Animal Legal Defense Fund last year, and I'm an animal guy. I train law enforcement officers and prosecutors on how to do these cases all over the country. Most recently, I did a training in Jefferson County with the Humane Society of the United States for Eastern Oregon law enforcement on this specific issue. This is a good bill. It is not overbroad. In fact, if anything, the definition of a treadmill is overly restrictive, because if you read the last clause in that language, it talks about a wooden set of slats for a slat mill. So if I'm a dog fighter and I have any brains and I'm reading the legislative history, I'm putting fiberglass or composite slats on my mill, and now I don't have a problem. So it's a little bit narrowly construed there. However, the protections in the crime itself of possessing dogfighting paraphernalia, specific intent, as you noted, Mr. Chair, is required to prove this offense. So anything that spins that you put a dog on isn't going to have implications in Oregon for dogfighting unless you're intending to use that to train the dog as a dogfighting dog or as a fighting dog. So this is a good bill. We support it wholeheartedly, and I'm here to answer any questions. Specifically, the felony provisions regarding participating in a dogfight, there are some in-the-trenches practical realities to prosecuting these cases that perhaps might come to bear as to why it's a good thing to make this a felony, elevating it from a misdemeanor. First of all, over 90% of our cases are pled out. And if you start off as a Class A misdemeanor, you don't have a lot of room to move as a prosecutor when you've got somebody who's a dogfighter. So elevating the crime gives the prosecution some room to negotiate, which creates incentive on the part of those that are being targeted to maybe roll over and allow the prosecution and the investigation to work up this food chain, just like in an organized drug ring, so that you can identify those players who are sponsoring these events, contracting the fights, funding the enterprise, and bringing the event together. So this is a good bill. It's good public policy, and certainly the Animal Legal Defense Fund supports it. I know that the Oregon District Attorney's Association is considering this bill. Their committee hasn't met yet, so they haven't been able to take a public position, but if I were a betting man, I'd know where they'd be on this one.
Questions? Yeah, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Heiser, congratulations on your job move. I think it's a good one. You were talking about the treadmill. I don't know the difference between, I know what an electric treadmill is. I've occasionally been on one, probably not as often as I should, but a modified electric treadmill or a slat mill, which is the one that has the wooden slats. What is a slat mill?
A slat mill is like a carpet mill. It's a treadmill, but instead of the running surface being, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, a slat mill is like any other form of treadmill, but the running surface is comprised of typically wooden or fiberglass or composite narrow slats so that they can make the corners on the treadmill itself. It's just a different texture. A running surface is all.
Well, Mr. Chair, can I follow up? Couldn't you say in section on sub C then, a slat mill with a running surface constructed of wooden or composite slats? Or does that capture another type of mill that someone else would be using?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, you could use more broader than that even. You could say a slat mill with a running surface constructed of slats commonly comprised of fiberglass, wood, or other similar materials. Mm-hmm. Or you could just call it a slat mill. For that matter, I did. If you'd like, I've got some language that I drafted in preparation for Legislative Council's review of this, and it didn't get picked up, and I'm not sure why, but that's okay. But I have some language on the specific definition of a treadmill. If you would like me to read it in the record, I'd be happy to do that.
Well, I wouldn't mind because I would think that someone could be as smart. I mean, they're pretty dumb to do what they do, but sometimes they show elements of smartness and intelligence. And if they're trying to get around the law. And they want to make this treadmill, the slat mill, with something other than wood, and they do, and they just wouldn't have one.
Well, Scott, before you do that, the chair is interested in modifying that definition. I was already encircled it, too, as maybe just taking the word wooden out. I think instead of us reading it in the record, if you can just provide it to the council, I would like to go ahead and see if we can't get an amendment. Just to maybe tighten that up or broaden it as it may be to make certain that we're not coming back here in 2 years or whatever and saying that, you know, it would have been great if it had fiberglass or some other type of composite or some other type of material listed and we couldn't do anything because it wasn't. Is that all right, Senator?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to do that.
All right. Other questions?
Chairman of the committee. Scott, what do you mean by carpet mill?
Mr. Chair, Council, a carpet mill is exactly that. It's basically a treadmill, typically not motorized, but the running surface is just carpet spliced together. And that's for the dogs to get traction so they have a better bite with their claws.
And as they run, Mr. Chairman, as they run, just like a regular running, I've been on a running track,
mm-hmm.
And as they run, it moves?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
I still want to ask the question about the collar. I'm kind of confused why the broader collars are something that they use, and it's not a problem with the bill. I'm just kind of curious about it.
Mr. Chair, Senator, typically dog fighters will use thicker collars on their dogs because commonly they'll chain these dogs or weight them with they'll use heavy gauge chain or apply weights so that these dogs build up their shoulder muscles and become much more powerful. So they need a wider collar to prevent the gouging injuries that are associated with a narrow collar and using that kind of weight.
They're just basically trying to condition the dog to be a higher performer when they're in competition. I think you call that competition.
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Heiser could probably answer that. This language says that if you're in possession of these items, it doesn't say you have to be in possession of two or more. It's just any one of these items by themselves would indicate that you were in the dog fighting business, correct? Or you'd be in violation of this law.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, if I'm in possession of a slat mill and there's evidence, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that I'm using that slat mill or intend to use that slat mill to train my dog as a fighting dog, then yes, I am liable for possession of dog fighting paraphernalia under Oregon law.
Okay, well, why I thought about that was because I was looking at unprescribed veterinary medicine that is a prescription drug, and so I got the statute out to see what was defined as a prescription drug because, you know, when my dog was ill, I gave him homeopathic remedies and things, but we went to an alternative physician, veterinary doctor, to get that. So if you have in your possession an unprescribed veterinary medicine, then you could also be subject to this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, again, only if you're in possession of those compounds with the intent of treating a dog that's been injured in a dog fight that you've been using in a dog fight.
All right.
Counsel.
Chair, Mr. Heiser, you as a former prosecutor, give us an example of what you would consider evidence that would show that the intent that the paraphernalia is being used for dog fighting.
Chair, counsel, probably the best form of evidence of intent in a dogfighting investigation, and these actually exist, believe it or not, are written contracts setting up the fight themselves and an agreement on the specific rules to be used in the fight. There are written rules. If you Google on the internet this afternoon, Cajun dogfighting rules, you'll see a set of rules that are unique to sort of the Louisiana part of the country, although they're applied all over the country, that dictate how this fight's going to occur. And as part of that, there will be a specific contract about the weight classifications that will be established and the payout and the purse that's going to be at stake for this dogfight. So a dogfighting contract is the best evidence, short of a wiretap, mm-hmm. that you're going to have to show specific intent. Short of that, commonly, the best way to prove it is through injuries that exist, healed injuries on dogs that are consistent with, through the expert testimony of veterinarians, yes, this dog's been the victim or has been involved in a number of fights. You can create the inference to be drawn by the jury as well through those types of injuries. And if you've got inartfully treated wounds that are obviously not done by a professional veterinarian, poor stitching, poor suturing, that type of thing, you can also make the case that way as well. There are a number of others.
Thank you.
Okay. So, but at the same time, if someone went on and Googled and copied this stuff down for a research project, just because they have that in their hands and they own a dog, that's not itself going to be enough for you as a former prosecutor to act on that. You'd have to have something else that actually was showing that they were intending to use that for that purpose. And I just want to put that on the record.
Absolutely true, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Senator, what do I say?
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. On the fact sheet here, you have indicated that there's federal legislation being introduced to essentially do the same things we're doing here. Do you know what the course of that activity in Congress is?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the federal legislation that criminalizes animal fighting has been around. In fact, the most recent passage that I'm aware of related to cockfighting and the interstate transport of spurs and the like. The Michael Vick case wasn't made on dogfighting per se. It was made on a conspiracy charge, and that shows one of the loopholes. The federal laws typically, though, as a matter of practice, are of limited to no value to a state prosecutor because there are so very few cases that the U.S. Attorney's Office is able to take in today's environment. So we need the best state tools possible. And Oregon's actually pretty good. Just as a compliment to this committee and others in this body, Oregon has, as the only state in the union that has racketeering, animal fighting is a predicate act in Oregon for racketeering, and that's exceptionally rare. So we should be applauded for that in this state.
Follow up, please.
Yes.
Yeah. Perhaps you haven't seen this fact sheet.
There is a bill. Chair Brzezinski and Senator Woodson, there is a bill. It has
Kelly,
had several hearings.
You need to put your name on the record. Just
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
It's Kelly Peterson with the Humane Society of the United States. That bill was a dogfighting bill. It was introduced, and it's had several hearings, but it's still in Congress, and I don't believe it's passed either chamber yet.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Ms. Peterson, do you have any other comments that you'd like to make for us?
I think I probably gave you a very thorough packet, but I did want to get on the record just in comparison to some of the states and where they are in terms of the laws on spectator. I do have information. It's not with me, but we do have it highlighted for every state exactly what the penalty is for a felony. If you care to have that, I can definitely share that with you at a later date at the next hearing if there is one at work session. I don't even know that I have much more to add except for, I think in many ways this is definitely a gateway crime, and elevating the penalties to a felony is definitely a deterrent. And that's in large part why we have, over 25 law enforcement endorsements. And that's, again, in your packet. So I won't restate everything. It's been said already.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator.
Ms. Peterson, you have some work to do in Georgia, Idaho, and Montana.
You know, there are 23 states, I think, that have these types of issues that are pending.
Well, those three states say it's okay and legal to be a spectator of a dogfight, and they're the only three in the entire country that allow that. So you've got some work to do there.
We do.
Okay, if there's no other questions, thank you all for coming forward. And it looks like, based on a note I got, only one other person is scheduled to testify on this, Mike Oswald. And is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony on this bill, Senate Bill 1072?
Chair Brzezinski, excuse me.
Yep.
Mike Oswald. I'm the director of Multnomah County Animal Services in Portland. You've heard from the experts on this. I just wanted to add some additional information about what happens with animals in these kinds of cases. We talk about criminal activity, and we talk about people being arrested and prosecuted, but this does involve dogs that are seized in these cases. And these dogs that are seized in cases end up being held in animal shelters in cities and counties across the state. And in the animal shelter world where we work, we see evidence of this activity going on a fairly regular basis. We see the injuries for dogs that have been abandoned or injured in the community, the injuries that are consistent with activity where they've been involved in fighting, whether it's intentionally or not, the history of scars and other kinds of injuries to their head and front legs and so forth, which is consistent with the activity of dogfighting. And those animals stay in shelters for long periods of time during these cases while there's prosecution. It's important, I think, that the role of the cities and counties in these kinds of cases is primarily to house and care for animals and be a partner in investigations. As you just heard, these are serious criminal activities. Police are involved in these investigations, which is appropriate. They have the resources and the skills necessary to deal with this level of criminal activity. And the county and city animal service folks out there are there to care for animals, provide support for those investigations, and also house animals during any prosecution that may go on. We also see in shelters, especially in the urban areas, which is true across the country, that there's really a growing number of aggressive dogs that are ending up in public shelters. This is kind of an indication of a popularity in breeds that are oftentimes used in this kind of activity, where these animals are being either intentionally or inadvertently bred and abandoned in the community for all kinds of reasons and end up in shelters. And so there's really an impact on counties also and cities that are involved in any kind of a animal sheltering activity. And this particular bill really gives prosecutors more tools so that when these cases do come forward, it gives them more clarity when it comes to what's evidence in a case that can lead to successful prosecution. Again, you've heard from the experts here. I just wanted you to know about the impact on counties and be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Oswald, are these poor animals rehabilitatable as pets once they've been involved in dogfighting operations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's one of the sad states of this whole activity is oftentimes dogs that have been bred for this kind of illegal activity are not placeable in the average home. There's a struggle for all shelters to find appropriate placements for dogs that have been trained to be aggressive and to be fighting dogs. It's difficult placing animals in a community as it is
let alone having dogs that have been trained and involved in fighting. There are, on occasion, ways and resources available to shelters that they can be placed in special kinds of facilities which can help deal with some of the behavior. But these are difficult dogs to manage behaviorally, and there's really rehabilitation is very, very difficult, and so oftentimes the fate of these dogs is not good.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
So, before I close the public hearing on this, Chair's, I guess, perspective on this is that we do need an amendment. I think Senator Walker's correct, at least based on the testimony I heard, the emergency clause would be appropriate so we can actually have this go into effect sooner than waiting until the beginning of next year. And then also, Council, if you'll work with Scott Heiser and cleaning up or tightening up that language on the treadmill to make certain that we're not so inclusive, or I say that we're more inclusive and not going to be dealing with this issue in future sessions to redefine what type of slap mill is made of. And so with that, then do you think it's possible that we could have this back before us on Friday?
Chair, members of the committee, I will be in conversation with Josh Nasby of Legislative Council's office, but as you know, he has a couple of other matters too. So I'll see if it's possible.
Okay,
it may depend on how good a language we get from Mr. Heiser.
Yeah. So, Scott, the pressure's on. So what we'll do is we're definitely going to have it as a fallback for the 12th, which is Tuesday. That's the last day that we can be moving stuff, so guaranteed we'll have it done then. If we can move it quicker and not interfere with LC on some other major projects that they're working on, we'll try to move it up quicker. But we'll make certain that it's scheduled for work session no later than Tuesday. Any other comments on this bill? We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1072. And colleagues, this covers what we have for today, unless there's something else that we need to do. Any comments? If not, thank you, everyone, and we're adjourned.